From Wondery, I'm Rufus Griscom, and this is a special episode of The Next Big Idea. It's part five of a mini-series we're calling Rethinking Big Ideas. Here at NBI Central, we're always on the lookout for fresh perspectives on the world around us and ideas for how to navigate a changing landscape of challenges and opportunities. We explored lots of those in season one of our podcast. But it's funny how you can have a great conversation and then something comes along, I don't know, let's say a global pandemic, and it makes you wonder, does what we just talked about still apply? Or does it maybe apply even more? So that's what we're doing. We're calling people back and asking them to help us understand the moment we're in. Today, I'm talking with Yancey Strickler. Back in 2009, he and a couple friends started a little startup called Kickstarter. He took it from a pie-in-the-sky idea that venture capitalists called cute, but unworthy of investment, to a platform that's helped artists and inventors and entrepreneurs raise billions of dollars for their big ideas. I always love talking with Yancey. He's a great combination of big thinker and big dreamer. He doesn't believe things have to be the way they've always been. Last fall, he summed up his latest thinking in a book called This Could Be Our Future, A Manifesto for a More Generous World. I called him over a pretty funky internet connection at his house in LA.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
Yancey Strickler, thank you for coming back to the Next Big Idea podcast.
Happy to be here with you, Rufus.
I so enjoyed our conversation in season one, which you'll recall we had a live conversation in New York City back in the fall. And of course, things have changed radically since then. So we're circling back with some of our favorite folks to talk about some of their ideas and how they're relevant in the current moment. But to start off, how are you? How are you? How is your wife and son? How are you guys doing?
Fantastic. I'm very blessed that my family and I are doing great, that the people I care about are safe. From the micro experience of my family has been, you know, really wonderful. And like, I have really treasured it. So it's, you know, it's been largely good. How about yourself?
Thank you for asking. I have three boys, and so it has not been boring. But it has been, like you say, it has been like a really nice kind of exercise in a lot of family time. And we've been certainly among the lucky ones.
Yeah.
Well, you were on my short list of people to call in this moment, Yancey, because I so enjoyed our last conversation about your new book, This Could Be Our Future, A Manifesto for a More Generous World, a really thoughtful, compelling book that made a real impact on me. And this is such a challenging time right now for so many people, of course. So many people are suffering. We're among the lucky ones. But I find myself looking for silver linings in the spirit of don't waste a good crisis, as Winston put it. The question on my mind is, maybe we can do something with this moment. Maybe it can be a catalyst.
Yeah, I think that these crisis moments are, you know, they're tectonic shifts that open up deeper layers of how we operate. I think that sort of values and how we make decisions kind of operates like a stack. Like, I think of the tech stack as a metaphor where you have like a database built on that as some backend architecture, then some, you know, front end code on the end, and then you have a user experience. I think values sort of start with a moral layer. On top of that, you build like rules and norms that sort of express what those morals should mean. And then on top of that, you create incentives and metrics that try to guide people towards a positive outcome.
I like that. Yeah.
And so in these moments of change, what happens is those incentive and rule levels get pushed aside a bit, right? Mm-hmm. The rules aren't as important. A crisis is the moment when bullshit stops, right? Mm-hmm. And so you get to that moral level. And so in this case, I think it's a very interesting question. What, you know, we talk so much about returning to normal. Mm-hmm. What is normal? What is normal?
Right.
You know, is normal just that we all have so-so jobs? Is normal that we're not spending time with our kids as much? Is normal, you know, what does normal mean? And so being clear on what does a successful society look like? What does recovering from a crisis look like? Requires a level of self-awareness and like definition process that on a day-to-day level you never get to, because you just wake up and the world's the same as it was the day before. So why think about anything? And so there's a funny level of just sort of confrontation with deeper and deeper truths about our world mm-hmm. in a way that isn't possible during a normal period of time. Mm-hmm. I would still choose to not have this happen, right? I would still choose this not happening. But I do think that there are some exciting developments that will come from this.
It strikes me that part of what happens in crisis is that we're forced to look beyond the insular myopic concerns we usually have about our own immediate objectives and to look more broadly at collective objectives and to look with a longer time horizon at how we solve problems. And this, of course, I'm lobbing you a softball, Yancey, plays right into this bentoism concept that you put forth in your recent book.
Yeah, you know, in the book, the book is about sort of how we operate according to a very limited definition of self-interest, that we picture our self-interest as what I want and need right now. And we sort of don't see much farther ahead than just like our immediate individualistic needs. My argument is that the spectrum of self-interest, the space of self-interest is far broader than that. That if you visualize that now me mindset as like the hockey stick graph, where a line of your self-interest, whatever it is growing so fast, the line goes up and to the right. But to imagine that that graph, just like a simple XY axis graph, is just a small slice of a much larger picture, because the X axis measuring time, it goes from all the way from now far into the future. So in this, the first time I drew this, I sort of drew this chart, and suddenly I had a 2x2 of four boxes. One was now me, what I want and need right now, the bottom left mm-hmm. corner. One was the bottom right, future me, what the older, wiser version of me wants me to do. I always picture this as like my Obi-Wan Kenobi whispering back through time, telling me, you know, what mm-hmm. choice I should mm-hmm. make in this fork in the road.
Yeah.
And the top left, I have my now us, my family, my friends, the people that I have an emotional relationship with. Mm-hmm. And the top right is the future us, all those same people 30 years from now, and whoever else is around then too. And every decision we make leaves a footprint in all these spaces. We shape them all the time. But yet our world has operated according to this focus on only now me.
Yeah.
The first time I came up with this idea, I thought, what is this? What did I just draw a picture of with this four boxes? Uh-huh. And I wrote down beyond near-term orientation, because it's about seeing beyond the near term. And I suddenly realized that was an acronym for bento. And I thought, oh, wow, the bento box. You know, the Japanese lunch that has the compartments and lids, so you always have a balanced meal. And I just read something about how the bento honors the Japanese dieting philosophy of hara hachi bu, which says the goal of a meal is to be 80% full. That way you're still hungry for tomorrow. So bentoism, this bento box, was the same idea for our choices, to not just max out on right now,
yep.
But to leave space and to account for these other spaces. Now, this has been super interesting for me to deal with during the pandemic, during the lockdown, because I use this bento to make every choice in life. Mm-hmm. And I also use it as a weekly ritual where I sort of use the four spaces to provoke, like, what is my to-do list for the week ahead? What is my, not just what does my now me want me to do, but what does my future me want me to do? What are my now us obligations? And I do this on Sunday mornings. And the first time I did this after the lockdown, I looked at my bento, and normally I start with now me, because what I need right now is always the easiest thing. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea what to put. Hmm. I had no idea, like, what about my life before was relevant? I had no clue. And instead, when I looked at the now us space, mm-hmm. immediately there was a universe of things I needed to put there. And in that moment, I realized, wow, my default position has shifted from like an individualistic position to more of like a service position to the people that I need to be here for. And that allowed me to sort of accept this role change. And I can imagine another universe where I would be spending all my days feeling sorry for myself for how much less time I'm working than I was before. But instead, I feel like I am creating value in all kinds of ways every day, because I have this real awareness of everything that's going on.
It is quite extraordinary that you wrote down beyond near-term objectives, thought of the bento box. It really does fit perfectly. And I've been applying it, and it makes a huge amount of sense. And it does seem that perhaps for many people, there's a natural pull down and to the left to now me. And when we have any kind of challenge or crisis that requires us to collaborate and think more broadly and long term, all of a sudden we see all four quadrants, right?
You know, I've spent the last 8 months leading workshops, teaching people like how to use this, helping them develop their values. I've done this for maybe 1,500 people or something at this point. And
wow.
My like broad generalization is that men are quite surprised to discover there's space other than now me. That men have a hyper awareness of the now me space. The other spaces are tougher. They're tougher for me, you know. And that women, I would say, hear this model and they say, thank you. This helps organize the way my mind was already working. And for women, I often find that like stepping into the now me space is a bit more intimidating. I think we sort of default to different places, but sure. It's when our routines are disrupted that we become aware that it is a routine. You know, so much of success in the world before this point was about how many different things you could juggle, right? You had your work self, you had your family self, maybe you had your like your secret self, your animal self, your exercise self, all these different versions of ourselves. And they were often in conflict with each other. And now we're all living under the same roof with all of our conflict, whatever or whoever it happens to be. And so this is a real, it's a real deck shuffle. And I don't presume that these things are eternal. You know, the world will change and these things will process through those changes. But I don't think that these are realizations that we're going to forget easily.
One of my favorite points that you make in the book, that you make really effectively, is the observation that change, that large-scale changes in human behavior are actually much more common than we think. And they don't always move in the right direction.
Oh, sure.
I mean, it's not always progress. For instance, perhaps the most eye-opening example in your book to me of our capacity for really dramatic kind of fundamental change in a generation or so was this example of the poll of kids entering college, right? The highlight was, I think it was in 1967, that when kids entering college were asked about their priorities, the number one priority was, quote, to develop a meaningful philosophy of life. 85% said it was a priority. Only 41% said being well off financially was a top priority. Fast forward 50 years, I think it was 2016, 2017, the number one priority that we won't be surprised to hear is to be well off financially. 82% of people say their number one priority is to be well off financially. And developing a meaningful philosophy of life has fallen to 46%. So it's just a dramatic change in the attitude of young people.
If you look at that same study, I think it shows what is the optimistic scenario, which is over the past 4 or 5 years, there's been a new goal that's been rising, and that is to, quote, be a values entrepreneur. And I think that that is the kind of work that is going to be just a growing space of human investment. And I wouldn't be surprised to see in 30 years from now, it's like that and being well off financially are like neck and neck together. You know, I absolutely could see how that happens.
Mm-hmm. And you, Yancey, have a unique perspective on this because as a co-founder of Kickstarter, you've been a catalyst for change. Kickstarter was a nutty idea in 2009, right? I mean, the idea people will donate money to a startup without having dollar signs in their eyes. They'll just do it because they want to be a part of it and maybe get a small something. You know, that was strikes me as having been quite inconsistent with the prevailing cultural norm in 2009. Do you feel like maybe that was a Kickstarter has made a contribution to a shift in values?
Yeah, I mean, I think Kickstarter is economically irrational. You know, there is no economic utility for a backer on Kickstarter. And we've tried to raise money from, you know, whoever in the very early days. We ran into that obstacle with, you know, professional finance people. But our counter was, well, most creative ideas aren't going to make anybody money. And they contort themselves, they ruin themselves trying to make money. Mm-hmm. And in fact, a universe where ideas can exist, not because of their financial potential, but just based on what other qualities of goodness other human beings might you know, discern in them, that that is a better way to orient our collective effort. That is a better way to distribute our money. So like the whole core premise of Kickstarter was that the financial motive is extremely useful for a broad set of things. Mm-hmm. However, this financial motive is a contorting figure, is a can even be a sacrilegious figure in other forms of human behavior. And when we try to fit everything through that same peg, there's a lot that gets left out. And for us as a business, like, you know, when we're talking in 2009 to people, they're saying, oh, so you're trying to help starving artists. Where's the money in that? But of course, what we see is there's a lot of us. There's a lot of us who want to do the things we can't do. And even though none of us individually have that much economic value, collectively, we absolutely do. And so there's just these, like, we believe these things, but still you have a lot of anxiety of like, are we, you know, but is that true? You know, you leave the meeting, you're like, are any of those things true? Will this work out? And we always pursued this very specific idea of success. Like for us, success was being meaningful to a creative community over the long term. It was not a financial outcome. It was not for us to get rich. It was, you know, and that led to us making Kickstarter Public Benefit Corporation and just trying to be a role model. Thinking we as creative people feel alienated from the business world, but yet our idea needs to be a business to succeed. And we think that there are a lot of people out there like us that would have a tremendous impact in this world, but who feel alienated by it because their value system is different than the dominant value system of this universe. So what if we carve out our own path that others can follow? And I think that people who are critical of capitalism talk a lot about a race to the bottom, lowering standards. But I think that there's a race to the top of like rising standards through competition and through people being willing to make bold investments into new spaces. And others will follow.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by TIAA. In the last 100 years, we've seen financial markets swing, new currencies come and go, decades of savings lost in days, all showing that a retirement plan without a guarantee, quite simply, isn't enough. So more than a retirement plan, TIAA makes you a retirement promise, a promise of a guaranteed retirement paycheck for life, a promise that pays off. Learn more at TIAA.org/promisespayoff.
One of the most interesting moments in our last conversation for me was when you talked about being scared by the success of Kickstarter early on. And what you said is you said, I felt terrified. And I think this was just after it sort of just erupted. It took a year. I thought, shit, nothing is as solid as we think. Right. And then I think you later said all that was required for Kickstarter to succeed was for a lot of people to believe in it. And there was something kind of scary about that. Can you speak to that?
I mean, I was born in 1978. So like, I believe in institutions, you know, I was brought up with a certain set of assumptions about the world. And the Kickstarter experience for me really, really invalidated a lot of those, you know, a lot of the structure and security that I thought was there, I discovered was just like a fiction that I had believed in. But I think I always, because I'm a creative person who, like, I'm an artist kind of at heart who got pulled into business and who felt like kind of a class traitor because of that. I always had a lot of emotional struggles, even with our success. You know, as we became more successful, it made me feel like, you know, am I still my artist self? You know, there was a point where the company started taking off, where I started taking oil painting classes because I just like needed to ground myself in that.
What I understood you to be saying was that part of what was frightening to you was that what appeared to be a very kind of static and reliable world was actually really fungible and changeable. And there was something kind of frightening about that. And I think you said that later you started to feel that that was kind of a superpower, that it was incredibly exhilarating to realize, like, wait a second, there's so many things we take for granted as being just the way the world is that we can change.
Yeah. I mean, I think that first reaction maybe was to think, yeah, how many things am I taking for granted that I'm just being a sheep about? You know, I'm just not, my eyes are not open in any kind of way. And I think I realized that was probably true in a lot of areas of life. But then there did become this experience as it went on longer, where you do just, there's just this different way you have of seeing the world after having sort of touched it in a way where you can, you're stepping a bit outside of it and you are, you know, touching your hand against this like fourth or fifth dimension you weren't aware of, and you can see your imprint, you know, and that can really mess with people, you know, I mean, that can create some real God complex human beings.
Right.
But it's also something that for me made me feel like a sense of awe, an awe of everything that is here, you know, mm-hmm. an awe of human capacity in general. And to just see myself as just like yet another instrument of that, you know, yet another expression of it. And yeah, and to like, you know, it's the Steve Jobs line about, you know, the people who changed the world are no different than any of us. And there is a moment where you really feel that. And it's amazing.
Totally, totally. You know, it strikes me that when we think about the opportunity to live in a more generous world, as you say in the subtitle of your book, and then circling back shortly to the question of whether this opportunity is particularly acute right now, whether the things that we can do to be a part of inciting some of that change. You know, it strikes me that when we talk about a cultural change that's possible, the metaphor I would use is cultural change is like they're boulders on a hill that can be freed by removing small rocks and sticks. But there has to be a gravitational pull. In other words, like Kickstarter worked partly because as it happens, humans do want to support one another and collaborate, and they're not exclusively motivated by financial return, right? Yeah. I mean, it wasn't that you all sort of invented that from whole cloth. You recognized an appetite and created an opportunity for people to engage that appetite. And then everybody looked to their left and right and saw that this was happening and felt good about it and did more of it, right? And this is why I think, to me, this conversation is so important, because I think if we can recognize that we're capable of being much more collaborative, much more generous, much more focused on the collective good than we've been in recent decades. You know, Mark Cuban recently said after the coronavirus, we will have America 2.0. Now, I don't know what he meant by that, but what do you want America 2.0 to look like?
I am optimistic. I think the near term of the next 5 to 10 years is going to be very challenging, and maybe even a little bit longer than that. But I think it's going to force us to shift our value system, and that we've been operating on a belief that if we create enough financial growth, that we will end up in nirvana, right? And that story is not true. It's not going to work. And what we're discovering, you know, in this moment, what's happened is that our dashboard has expanded. We've gone from just a market-driven dashboard to suddenly it's like markets plus COVID death, you know, rates. And now we have a third dashboard, that plus unemployment. And we may end up soon having a fourth dashboard, which is like poverty or hunger. And so suddenly we're in this position of having to put financial growth in the context of other forms of value. And so we're having to shift from a singular dimension society to a multidimensional one, where we're having to balance trade-offs. Now, of course, as grown-ups, we know this is what we have to do all day long. Like, this is what life is. And it's difficult, but it's not impossible. It's what every company has to do. But yet, as a society and how America has oriented itself, we've just gotten, you know, just so seduced by financial ends. So I think that that's what has to change. And I think it's going to have to change. And I think the new paradigm is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet. But I think that over the next 10 years, it's going to come. And we're going to see that global health and non-financial values become central to our decision-making. And already there are like 5 or 6 countries that are pivoting their focus from GDP growth to growth on human well-being, and are trying to mathematically define these things. And not coincidentally, all of these countries are led by women. And so that is the new paradigm that we're moving towards. It is a social, it is a shared future rather than an owned and an individualistic one. And it's going to have to get darker for us to get there. But in the same way that we respond to corruption by elevating transparency, the same way that we respond to, you know, fear by coming together, I think that what we're going through is going to force us to ask what is valuable. And our answer for what is valuable is going to be different as a result of this crisis than it was 3 months ago.
There's an extraordinary prediction by John Maynard Keynes that you include in your book. In 1930, this is, of course, the legendary economist who wrote in an essay called Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren. He said, the human race will need to harness, this is not the quote, I'm paraphrasing. We'll need to harness the power of greed for 100 years to free ourselves from necessity. But he then said, when the accumulation of wealth is no longer of high social importance, which he thought would be in about 2030, there will be great changes in the code of morals. The love of money as a possession, as distinguished from the love of money as a means to the enjoyments and realities of life, will be recognized for what it is, a somewhat disgusting morbidity. What an extraordinary prediction almost, 90 years ago. Now, it was rather cynical of him to assume that we're going to have a greed-driven culture for 100 years to rise out of this kind of economic need. But there is a hopeful part of the message, too, which is like, hey, once we reach a certain level of productivity, we will be able to shift our morals in a direction that's going to be much more gratifying towards our fellow humans.
And I think the truth is that we might already be at that economic reality. You know, I mean, I was at a dinner last fall and I sat next to a couple billionaires, a first for me. And one of them ended up expressing to me how, like, there's so much money on the sidelines, I wouldn't believe it. But, you know, none of that money was being invested because there wasn't anything worth putting money into. And this is like, while the world is burning, someone is saying this. So we've had this very limited notion of what success means. But yeah, I think that transition is happening. You know, there's another book that I really admire. It's by Peter Drucker, the business guru of all business gurus, called The Post-Capitalist Society. And he wrote this in 1990. And what he foresaw was that the growth of capital, financial capital, would no longer distinguish the most meaningful and important companies in a category from the other. And in fact, what would be the most meaningful thing to grow would be knowledge, their own knowledge. That knowledge would grow to overcome capital as the most important value system. And that the change that he predicted by 2020, the change he thought was that money would be used to grow knowledge, that the growth of knowledge would be the most critical thing in the economy. And that at that point, we would move into, as he put it, a post-capitalist future. And post-capitalist didn't mean that capitalism did not exist. In fact, it meant that capitalism had won, but that we were building other values on top of it. And so that's the point we're reaching. And I think that the technological tools available to us make us very well equipped for this.
Yep.
So again, I think we could do that. And I think that we can make that change and it be like a rational, non-political change that will just be about producing better outcomes.
Well, and right now we are in a moment where we're all cooking at home. There's no eating in restaurants. Consumption is down. But consumption of online learning is up, depending on where you look, 5x, 10x, right? I mean, so this period of time is a period where we are testing kind of shifts in values. It seems to me.
I think people are open to so many ideas right now.
Fantastic. Well, I have been using my Bento and I find it to be very useful. I highly recommend This Could Be Our Future, A Manifesto for a More Generous World, really eye-opening book. And we so appreciate your time, Yancey.
Thanks so much, Rufus. Really appreciate it. Stay safe.
We are delighted to see this increase in interest in lifelong learning that's happening right now, because that is our mission at the Next Big Idea Club, to deliver life-changing ideas in accessible formats. If you'd like to get a regular supply of great ideas from authors like Yancey, join us. Our curators will send you e-courses, videos, and audio highlights from the most groundbreaking new nonfiction direct from the authors themselves. To try us out for 3 months free, just go to nextbigideaclub.com/podcast. Special thanks today to Yancey Strickler. You can check out his Bento system at bentoism.org. He's also offering weekly online sessions at bit.ly/weeklybento. That's bit.ly/weeklybento, all one word. You've been listening to a special coronavirus edition of The Next Big Idea. Next week, I'll be speaking with Priya Parker, a master of meaningful gathering. She'll have all sorts of ideas about how to build community, even if you're cooped up in a cabin or a tiny apartment, or in my case, in a house with three rambunctious boys bouncing off the walls. I'm your host, Rufus Griscom. Our sound design is by Jake Gorski. Caleb Bissinger is our associate producer. Our series producer is Michael Kovnat. Jonathan Miller is our senior producer. Our executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Marshall Louie, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.